Hello, and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. When you're finished with this one, you can help yourself to more than 1,000 other podcasts, all free, on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or through iTunes.
How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no. So, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. It was like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And look, I don't know. It's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations on a Friday. This is how it goes. You know the story. We've all read about it plenty of times. A couple gets married. They have kids. They break up. It's a nasty breakup. And they become badly estranged. Then one parent comes for an access visit to take the kids for the afternoon. And then that parent takes off with the kids to another country. Once they're settled in the new country, that parent sits down with the kids and tells them a sad story. They won't be seeing the other parent anymore because, well, that parent has passed away. Best get on with life in this new country. Meanwhile, the parent left behind in Australia is shocked, distressed. They try every avenue to get the kids back, but Australian authorities can only do so much. And that's when they sometimes choose to come to someone like my guest today. His name is Keith Shafirius. Keith Shafirius is a private investigator who has specialised in child retrieval. Over the last 3 decades, Keith has slipped into countries like Poland, Yemen, and the Philippines to retrieve children for a deeply anxious mother or father. It's a job that's difficult, dangerous, and often quite fraught for the children torn between two parents. Keith Shafirius, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Richard.
I'm looking in front of me at the moment. You've brought in some stuff. A Rhodesian passport, a passport for British Honduras. Those countries don't exist anymore, Keith.
But they did, and they had passports.
You've used these to get into countries?
For identification within countries, and once I did use it to get into an Arab country.
Did they notice that Rhodesia doesn't exist anymore?
They didn't. They allowed me through, would you believe?
They stamped it?
Stamped it.
You've also got a letter there from the Ministry of the Interior from Yemen?
That was from the Minister of the Interior after we'd been there for a while and had a few problems with the military and security within the country. I complained to him one day that we were being stopped and delayed, so he said, you come to my office tomorrow. When I went to the office, he did this letter. It's all in Arabic, but when I had it translated, it gave us the freedom of the city. We were allowed to go anywhere and do anything within the city. And when we showed that to the military or the security or anyone within the country, they would wave us on and let us go. Keith, of course, it cost a few dollars.
Keith, you've also got a letter there from Al Gore and a film script for a film that never existed and was never going to be made called Return to Aden. Now, I want to get to that and to the letter from Al Gore a bit later on. Can we just begin, though, by talking about how you work? Just hypothetically, if I come to you, Keith, and say my wife has taken my child or children overseas, and I'd just say at this point she hasn't. that's just being purely hypothetical. But if I am coming to you and saying this has happened and I want them back, what happens then?
Richard, the first thing I will do is do a full background research on the family and the children, their well-being in this country, go to the extent of speaking to their school principals, their church friends, Sunday school. I want to see all of the court documents in relation to custody before I make a decision to know that morally I'm doing the right thing by those children and the family. So I accepted about 3 out of 5 cases that came to me.
About 60% of cases, you
accept? About 60%.
And you do need to be persuaded in your own mind that you've got to have this morally right in your own mind before you begin.
That's correct. And in all cases where I've recovered children, I have satisfied the children that they should have been back here. Children who have grown up and have been interviewed said, yes, Keith did a great job.
Is that the foundation of everything you do, to be morally persuaded this is the right thing to do?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the money didn't worry me. I did 2 cases without any professional fees whatsoever, just for out-of-pockets, airline, motel, and out-of-pocket expenses.
And then you put that to the person, the client who comes to you, and you say, well, first of all, to begin with, I'm going to have to check out your bona fides.
Yes, and check it out. If they don't want me to check their bona fides, well, I don't accept the case.
Which parent is more likely to abduct their own children, a mother or a father?
The father, probably about 60% of the cases, it's the father, and 40% the mother. Usually with the father, it's more in spite. of the relationship.
Or in spite?
Yes. He really doesn't want the children. Most of them I've found the father didn't want the children. For example, the one I did in Poland in the early 90s, the father took the children there and just left them with their grandmother and went on his own way of doing whatever he wanted to do. And the children were living in fairly squalid conditions.
That's an incredible thought, to go to that trouble and do that.
In fact, the little girl, she was 9, and she was sleeping on an old lounge with a dog, didn't have a proper bed.
How about if the mother abducts the child? What's the main motivation there?
Less likely to be out of spite and more motherly love, where the mother appears to be more attached to the children in most of those cases than the father. The father is, you know, either has been or was cruel to the children, and the mother has taken them away for a better lifestyle and a better education, better standing.
How does the law work with this, Keith? Do you need to be legally enabled to do this by Australian law before you start?
Richard, I always had great assistance from Department of Foreign Affairs and Immigration. There was a guy in Canberra who knew me fairly well and what I was doing, and he would always assist with production of duplicate passports, travel documents, but he needed to know there was a court order in place first, and assisted in many countries that I went to from a phone call to go to their embassy and have new documents produced, because most times we didn't have documents for the children to travel, and that was the reason we smuggled them out of countries to a nearby country, so for example from Poland to Germany to get the travel documents.
Does this create ructions within DFAT? Because I imagine if you're taking children, in some places you're breaking the law of the country that you're slipping into. That happens from time to time. I mean, you're using fake passports for a start. I mean, do they then complain to our own Department of Foreign Affairs?
I've never known them to complain to our department because I've got in and out without being known. The case I did out of Poland, I met the head of the Warsaw Police some several years later after he had retired, and I mentioned to him, in fact, I was on the way back to Poland to do another recovery, and I mentioned to him what I was doing, and he said, "Keith, be careful, because you can be arrested for kidnapping." I said, "Well, I did a case about in the early 90s, and his eyes sort of lit up. He said, "It was you, was it?" He said, "You were wanted, but we didn't know who we wanted." He came in handy later on the case we were going in for. So my associate, Logan Clark, was arrested when we were bringing the child back out of Poland, arrested at the border and taken back to court to appear in court. And after making contact with some of our high-ranking contacts, we paid $5,000 to the magistrate and Logan was delivered back to the German border.
Often in these situations, you are putting yourself above the law in these countries. Does that worry you?
No, I never had any fear of the law or of my own well-being. I guess if I did, I wouldn't have gone there and done those cases.
Let's talk about the first child that you helped retrieve. This was back in the 1970s.
Yes.
And in Italy. Tell me about the circumstances behind that.
The circumstances with that one, the mother had taken the children back to Italy, and the father contacted me. I made inquiries, found where the children were on the west coast of Italy. The father paid for me to go over. I carried out some surveillance.
What did you see?
I saw that the mother was taking the children to a hotel every weekend, and they'd be in the beer garden while she was prostituting herself, and the children were just drinking a soft drink and eating chips for the day, and I thought that would be an excellent opportunity to take the children. So a few weeks later, I took the father over, and the same thing happened, and the mother went to the toilet, and we had someone there who locked the toilet door, and by the time she raised an alarm and got out, we were well and truly gone, and in fact, on a boat, headed back to, we went to Switzerland on that one.
You were able to lock her in the toilet for a while.
Yes.
Did you make the approach to the children or did the father?
The father. I always have someone with me that the children can relate to, who know the children, whether it be the mother or the father or a close relative that the children can relate to.
And what do you remember of that moment when the children saw their father?
Quite surprised to see him there. The one child screamed, didn't realise his father was anywhere in the country.
Screamed with delight or with terror?
With terror. Screamed with terror.
Why? Why?
Just the shock of seeing the father. Goodness knows what the mother had told them about their father. In one particular case, the father had told the children the mother had died. She'd been killed in a car accident. And it was quite horrific for the children to realise that mum was still alive and was there.
So then how do you make that step then between a child screaming at the sight of her father and who knows what she has been told about this father, as you say?
Children calm down fairly quickly, from my experience, after they realise the father is there to help them or take them back. That child was 9 at the time, the one who screamed, but settled down very quickly.
What do you tell the father or mother to do in that situation? Do you have to, there's obviously, time is of the essence.
That's
You've got
right.
to move very quickly. What do you tell the parent?
Mummy's taking you home, you're coming back home with mummy, or coming back home with daddy, and settle the children down in whatever way. And a parent knows how to settle their children down when they're screaming or traumatised.
So you had a boat nearby?
Yes, a fast boat, and took off up the coast of Italy, headed back inland to Switzerland, and we obtained documentation there.
Have you ever had to medicate the children to calm them down?
Yes, the first ones out of Poland.
Take me from the start of that story, the children in Poland, because that's a fascinating story. There were two children there.
There was two children from Brisbane where the mother and father had separated and divorced. They were living at Buranda in Brisbane, and the father had access as much as he wanted. He could see the children after school for the weekends, and on one particular day he contacted the mother and said, "I'm going to take the children to the circus tomorrow afternoon." So next day he went to the school at 11:30, 12 o'clock, and told the teachers that he had a dental appointment for the children. But in fact, he had booked flights out to Poland and left Australia at about 1:30 on that afternoon and headed for Poland. Of course, the children didn't arrive home from school, and when the mother made inquiries through friends of the family, they were told that the father had sold up everything and had gone back to Poland with the children. And it was late at night by then, so 9 o'clock at night when she contacted the police, they found that he had already been into Singapore and had taken off for Poland on the Polish airline. It was too late to restrain them or turn the plane around or bring them back. So it was 13 months later that I went in and retrieved the children.
13 months. How long was the interval before the abduction of the kids by the father? In between that and the time when she got in contact with you, Keith, how long did that take for her to find you?
It was about probably about 8 or 9 months, and during that period she tried everything through the legal system, through the courts, through the Hague Convention, and just couldn't get any satisfaction because Poland wasn't a signatory under the Hague Convention for abducted children at that stage.
So being early 90s, it's post-communist Poland.
Yes, it was.
But things are kind of chaotic in Poland at that time. Was she Polish herself?
She was Polish. And he was Polish, and the children had never spoken, or only a little bit of Polish. They were brought up in English schools. And when we retrieved the little boy off the street, he couldn't speak a word English anymore. He had forgotten English in 13 months and could only speak Polish.
So 13 months later, that's when you found the kids.
Yes.
And was that based, that wasn't really major detective work, I suppose. You found this man without too much trouble in Poland?
There was a little bit involved, and at that stage, there were no private investigators in Poland, but through contacts, I was able to find an ex-KGB guy who was starting off in private investigation, and he assisted to the extent of finding the children and, in fact, walked with them to school on one or two occasions to get to know them. I paid him his money, and he said, "Because I live here, that's as far as I can help you," gave us the address, and we did what we had to do.
So then you went over with the mother to Poland. You went with her?
Yes, the mother came with me to Poland, and I took an interpreter with me at that stage for the language barrier and found that I didn't really need him. So we went to the school where the children were going or to the address where they were living and found that only the little boy was living there, but the girl wasn't. On his way to school, we picked him up, and he told us that his sister had been taken away from that school and was going to another school. When we went to that school, she became hysterical and screamed, and the teachers became involved and called the police. So we took off with the little boy, and I was informed later that a roadblock was set up, but they missed me by about 3 minutes. And we got back to the airport because communications were not too good at that stage. Computers were down, telephone systems didn't work too well, there was crossed lines, delays, and we got out of the country and back to Frankfurt before the alert. 4 weeks later, against all odds, I went back to Poland with the mother and found the little girl.
You got back in. But as you said, you now know many years later, they didn't even know who they were looking for.
They didn't know who they were looking for.
Did you go in under a false passport? Or can you?
No, I used my passport, but through contacts, I was advised which border crossing to go through. I went over a little border crossing at Gorlitz, which is just down near Czechoslovakia, to test the water there. I asked the border guard if I could buy his cap. Initially, he said, no, you can't buy the cap because I can't get any more, but you can have the chicken or the badge. You know, he referred to it as a badge.
The chicken, the eagle, you mean?
The eagle, yeah. Right. And when it was interpreted, it was the chicken, but it was really the eagle. So I bought that for $50 American.
Is this to establish whether he's bribeable?
Yes, to establish. And I was informed by contacts always to carry a pocket full of American dollars, and you'll buy your way anywhere in those countries. So I paid him for that and found what shifts he'd be on. And they worked 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, and only received about $50 a month at that stage. So $50 was a huge wad of money to him. And we were assisted.
So you went into Poland, and this was to get the girl this time?
This was to get the girl.
Now, bearing in mind, the girl screamed when she'd seen her mother previously. Yes. And had you been present at that point?
I wasn't present. I was outside, and the mother went into the school.
Why did she scream? Did she heard that the mother was dead?
Heard that her mother was dead, and that the mother didn't want her, and became hysterical. But later, when we went back, 4 weeks later and picked her up, she was again screamed. I was carrying out surveillance and she screamed and struggled, didn't want to get into the car.
Where was this? At the school again? Or
no, this was on her way to home from school. We missed her in the morning because school is two sessions. One's in the morning from 8 till 12, the other session's from 1 till 4 or something like that because schools are crowded. They split the schooling into two sessions a day. We missed her in the morning. She wasn't at there. I used a taxi at that stage. I hid the hire car I had, used a taxi for surveillance, and spoke to the taxi driver. He could understand a little bit of English. I told him he must not talk, and I ran my finger across my throat and said, if you talk, that might happen. So he said, I know talk. And the little girl didn't come out of the residence where she should have been living, so I paid him off, then went and got my hire car back and carried further surveillance. The little girl came home at about after the midday session, and later we found that she had gone to the dentist that morning before school, and we had missed her.
Ironically, the dentist.
Yeah.
The cover story for her abduction in the first place.
Yeah, that's right.
So, Keith, you then had to abduct her, essentially.
Had to abduct her.
From the street?
Off the street. She was walking along the front of the house, just tapping on the fence. I parked the car in the driveway. I jumped out of the car and opened the door, and the mother was sitting in the back. The mother grabbed her then to take her into the car, and she held on and screamed. I loosened her fingers off the door and put her in and closed the door. And I had taken my son, my 12-year-old son, with me just for an adventure on that stage, and his duty was to give her a Coca-Cola that had sedative in it, and she loved Coca-Cola. So to calm her down, she was to drink this Coca-Cola. But she calmed down reasonably quickly after we were in the car, and I took off as fast as I could. Or before I took off, would you believe, it's left-hand drive there. I jumped into the right-hand side of the car and had to get out and run around the car to get in the other side. Took off, ended up in a one-way street with a barrier across the end, so I just ploughed through the barrier, and it was a timber barrier. Timber flew everywhere. I saw a police station not far away and just kept going. It was about 80 kilometres back to the border, and I just sped off because the police car's there, and I was advised they only allowed to do 30 kilometres a day and only had, I've forgotten how many litres of petrol they were allowed to use, and the cars were fairly old, dilapidated, so there's no way they could catch me. I was in a supercharged Ford Sierra.
And they were in an old Trabant or something like that?
Yeah, some old Russian vehicle.
You ran them out?
I ran them out. Late at night, it was winter, so about 5 in the afternoon, I saw blue lights flashing back, but because I was speeding and blue lights seemed to be getting further and further away. Got back to the border. On the way back, I said to the little girl, I don't have any documentation for you, and you're going to have to hide. And she said, "Mr. Keith, I can't do that because that's a sin and I'd have to confess." So I began to become a little bit worried. A little bit later on, probably about 10 minutes later, she said, "Mr. Keith, where would I have to hide?" I said, "Well, I've taken all the stuffing out under the back seat and you have to lie on the floor and I'll put the seat over you." And she said, "Can I practice?" So she did. And that's where she lay when we crossed the border. So my son, the mother, and myself, three passports we handed in at the border to the Polish guards. They took the passports inside. I got a little bit worried, but then the German guard came out and waved us through, gave us the passports back. Because it was all cheers and screams and everything. The little girl was back in Germany.
Keith, you had your 12-year-old son with you. How did he feel about this experience, watching Dad hoon along at just under 200 k's an hour, smash through a barrier, timber barrier, with a mother and child in the back there? What did he make of the whole experience?
He thought it was the most exciting adventure he could ever go on. He was a hero at school for years afterwards. He went to Churchy, and it was just before the school breakup. He left a week early for the Christmas breakup to come with me. And as a result of stories in various magazines in Australia, everyone wanted to hear about what he did, and he still talks about it today and says how his heart was thumping at first when I picked up the little girl. He wanted to go on more adventures.
It's a troubling story. I mean, it's exciting what you just told me. I'm troubled by the abduction of the girl, though, forcing her into the car. I can't see any other way you could have done it.
There was no other way because people were around everywhere, and when she screamed, the grandmother put her head out of the window to see what was happening, because the only option I had was to take off as fast as I could and get out of the town. It was a small town in the south of Poland, a small mining town.
How long did it take then for her to go from being screaming and fighting you to get into the car to becoming a co-conspirator who's quite happy to hide under the chair?
Almost straight away. When she got in the car and realised her mother was there and she was going back to Australia, she was calm.
What did she say to her mother when she saw it? Do you remember?
Started discussions, and her father had told her that her mother had died on that one. But when the mother started to talk and tell her that all of her Christmas presents were still under the tree from last Christmas and that her school friends were waiting for her, she was quite content and happy to come back to Australia.
I'm trying to imagine what it was like for you trying to drive that car at top speed, going down a dead-end street with a barricade, while a highly intense discussion is going on in the back seat between mother and daughter, and you're trying to evade police and the like. I don't know. How do you keep your head in that situation, Keith?
I keep very calm, and because I had no fear of anyone or anything, I was able to keep very, very calm and keep my mind on what I was doing and on the road. And I recall on one stage, my son looked down. He said, "Dad, you're doing 198 kilometres an hour," which was really, really fast on the roads over there.
Fast on the roads over here. So if you are without fear, how do you get to have no fear? How do you learn that, Keith?
I guess it's something that that you're born with, not to fear anyone and to be capable of taking care of yourself and being able to talk fast talk out of a situation. And that's happened on a number of occasions.
You have a military background.
I was in the Air Force for 6 years. And at the end of that Air Force career, I was seconded to ASIO for a short while, but never joined up permanently, and had a motel on the Gold Coast for a short while. And in 1969, I set up my own investigation business in partnership with a Queensland State Police officer. And after a few years, I bought him out.
I was just thinking, running a motel on the Gold Coast is about as different as you can get from
That's
what
correct.
You do currently at the moment. Was it just simply too quiet? Are you an adrenaline junkie, Keith?
Yes, I was. I've calmed down a lot now and quietened down.
How much does it cost to retrieve a child in these circumstances?
It can go from one end of the scale to the other, probably the cheapest one. Well, as I said, I did two for no costs at all, no professional fees, just the costs. Usually about $30,000 to $40,000. The one out of Poland that we spoke about was about $35,000. The one out of Yemen was $450,000 US, and that was all contributed by the young mother's church, friends, relatives, and so forth. The one out of the Philippines was paid for by the Swedish legal aid system because the father was Swedish and living in Australia, but still a Swedish citizen. That cost all up $1.4 million US, but that's not for my fees. That was for lawyers. There was a bribe of $125,000 US paid to an army general in the Philippines to help us with access. And after that bribe was paid, we flew everywhere in the president's helicopter.
Keith, you have in front of you at the moment a big ring binder with a film script in it. And the film goes by the title of Return to Aden. Now, this is something you used to retrieve a child from Yemen, Aden being the the capital, the seaport of Yemen.
Yes.
I want to get the story from you. Mm-hmm. Give me the background to that case.
This was for a young mother from Tacoma, Washington, in the United States, who had heard about some of the recoveries I had done. And I have an associate in the United States, Logan Clark, who assists on some cases. If he had a child retrieval case, I would go and help him, and he would come and help me. So as a result of this mother making contact, I flew to the United States, interviewed her, and did all of the background research while I was there, and then took on the case.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Conversations, broadcast, podcast, and online.
Keith Shafirius is a private investigator who specialises in child retrieval. This is in those cases where one parent has effectively abducted the children away from the other parent and brought them to another country beyond the reach of Australian law. Keith Shafirius is brought in to investigate the case when he's satisfied in his mind that retrieving the child is the correct thing to do. He slips into the country with the other parent and prepares to bring the kids back home. This has taken him to countries like Poland, the Philippines, and even Yemen on the Arabian Peninsula. Before, Keith, you were telling me about that case in Yemen where you went in pretending to be a film producer. Before we get to that, how did the two rival parents end up in this situation?
The mother had married an young Arab who was at university or college in the US, and she became pregnant to him and had a child. After a while, the male was not too nice to the child, molested the child, one of the children, and they separated, divorced. But through the courts, he had visiting rights to see the children every second weekend. And on one occasion, some friends told the mother that he had bought some large suitcases and may be thinking about smuggling the children out. So she went back to court. The judge didn't cut off his visitation rights, and one or two weeks later he smuggled the children out through Canada and back to Yemen.
Now, Yemen is, by my understanding, one of the most closed countries in the world. It's right down there at the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula, just below Saudi Arabia. Not easy to get into, a highly controlled state that's there in place. What do you then do? You said you contacted your friend Logan Clark, but how do you then contrive to get into a place like Yemen?
Well, we had to work out a way of getting in there, and to get in, Djibouti in North Africa was the closest country across the Red Sea from Aden. So one of our associates, not an associate, one of our employees who was ex-military naval SEAL, had served in the Gulf over there during the Gulf War, and he went into Yemen and befriended some people, a manager of a large security company, a British guy in Djibouti, had a boat, about a 30-foot fiberglass twin-hull boat, and Michael was the guy's name who went in there, and he talked this guy into allowing us to use the boat, and provided he got a byline in the film that was being made, and for the use of his boat. We paid him for the boat and had to use his skipper. So that was access from Djibouti across the Red Sea and onto the beach in Yemen.
Did you have the cover story of this film in place at that stage?
Had the cover story, Return to Aden, all set up. And we had copies of the script for the movie. The script.
Can I see that? Can you show this to me? This is a big ring binder, and it's got "Return to Aden" on the cover, which is a joke I suppose only an Australian would understand. It's a proper script.
It is the script of an old movie, and I've forgotten the title of a movie, but it was all about camels and deserts and love scenes. So it just fitted the location.
That's hilarious. What did this mean? This cover story. You went in with ring binder scripts.
We went in and we carried that and. on in a part of it there, we had pictures of well-known movie stars. In fact, Arnold Schwarzenegger is there, and various other people they thought would be coming into their country to be in this movie. And the motel we stayed at, would you believe, wanted to know, was Arnold Schwarzenegger bringing, did they have to get weightlifting equipment for him, or was he bringing his own? So after we conned everyone, including the government, they went out and bought all the best weightlifting equipment and set up a gymnasium in one of the rooms. We took in T-shirts with us.
You had T-shirts for Return to Aden?
We had T-shirts that we took in with us, all printed up, Return to Aden, filmed on location 1994 or whatever it was. And by the end of the first or second week, most of the government officials were wearing T-shirts with Return to Aden filmed on them. And they all really believed we were doing what we had convinced them we were doing.
And they bought all that weightlifting equipment.
Yeah.
So, well, hang on. You said you slipped into Yemen.
Logan and the mother and Michael, as we called him, went in on the boat. But I was to fly in through Dubai. I went to fly in, and there's only one airline going in at that stage, and that was Al Yamda Airlines, which is owned by Yemen. And to get a seat, you could only buy a seat at the door of the aircraft because you couldn't buy seats through travel agents or anything. I bought a seat in. And the guy I bought it from, he said, you won't have any problem when you get in there because I'll be there. But when we landed in Aden, he took off and left me alone. So some of my documentation wasn't quite right and one of the passports wasn't quite right. They couldn't work out what the problem was and I wouldn't tell them. So I was thrown into jail for a week and deported. Thrown in on the Monday.
Well, anyway, don't run over that. In jail in Yemen for a week.
Yes.
Describe that experience.
Not the nicest place. All that was in the cell, a cell about 10 feet by 10 feet with one wooden chair. And to sleep, I had to lie on the concrete floor or sit on the chair. The first 2 days, there was no food. I had to pay about $3 for a bottle of water. And then later I was given a banana and some sponge cake. The sponge cake just crumbled up and fell on the floor, but I ate the banana, which wasn't too bad, and I was deported on the Friday back to Aden. Not to Aden, to Dubai, sorry, back to Dubai. I paid a taxi to take me to Abu Dhabi, to the embassy, and I paid some money and got a new visa and used another passport and went back in and stayed for 4 weeks.
No problem this time?
No problem that time.
But this time you're going in as what, the executive producer of Return to Aden?
Yes, and we carried that with us. And to get to the properties where the child was, once we knew where the child was, we had property releases. And we'd get the people in the street to sign this release. We'd give them 10 American dollars. And, of course, once you pay two or three, all the other residents start coming to you. They all want their 10 American dollars. And they would sign a release allowing us to use their property for filming on location. And that's what we did to get into the street where the child or the children were living.
Tell me about that moment of retrieval then, the critical point of retrieving that child.
It was failed on the first attempt because the mother became ill and found later she had cancer and she had to be medevaced out. She was taken back to Dubai for an operation.
She became very ill. You've set up
we've
a
set
fake
it
film
all up.
Script. You've got
everything is set up, ready to go. And we had problem initially with the government there, but government officials would come to the hotel where we were staying. There's only one big hotel there. They would come there of an afternoon for their drinks because, as you know, no alcohol's allowed on the street or taken home. And we were able to befriend Minister for the Interior, and he assisted us no end. And we were paying a lot of bribes. Everywhere we went, people would want money. They'd say, do you have a gift today? And if you said no, they'd say, well, you sit there. And you know, 2 hours later, they'd come back and say, now have you got a gift? So I complained to Mohammed, Minister for the Interior, and he said, Keith, that will stop. I will come with you tomorrow. So I went with him, and we went around to all these people. He spoke in Arabic to these people, then went back to his office. He said, don't you pay them any more. You pay me now. So it was much simpler. There was only one payment to be made.
Save wasting a lot of time.
Yeah. And then moving around, we were being stopped by the military and security and immigration. So I went to his office and he compiled this letter all in Arabic. And after having it transcribed it's giving us the freedom of the city. We're allowed to move anywhere we wanted to. And if anyone stopped us, we showed them that letter and we were waved through.
And you're there to abduct a child, ultimately.
Yes.
Were you, with the mother being ill and having to return, what happened then?
We came back to Australia and had intended to go back, but the mother went in before us and she disappeared and she hasn't been found to this day. Believe she was killed by the family or relatives over there. So those children were never brought out of Yemen after having it all set up.
You never heard from her again?
Never heard from her again. And through her family in the United States, we were advised that she had disappeared in Yemen.
Has the United States, the United States government doesn't really have much relations to speak
no relationship
with Yemen, so
there at all. It's a breeding ground for terrorists, and they have no relationship there at all and got nowhere with the trying to locate the mother.
You mentioned paying a huge bribe in the Philippines. How much was it? $125,000
Was paid to an army general in the Philippines, and he was a general in charge of the presidential intelligence of the army. And after that was paid, we were introduced to him through people we knew or had contact with. And after that was paid, we flew everywhere in the president's helicopter. When we wanted to go to one of the provinces, it was in the president's helicopter. And the pilot used to look at us sometimes and wonder what was going on. And people on the ground would be looking up and waving because they thought the president was going over.
What were the circumstances of that case?
The circumstances were the father, a Swedish citizen, was living in Australia in Townsville. He went to Sydney, met a Filipina girl at a bus stop and married her, had a child, and then the marriage broke down when the little child was about 2 or 3 years of age, and she left and went back through United States, Canada, and back to the Philippines, and we had to locate the child and retrieve the child. It was a very, very difficult case, and that went on for over a year. My associate Logan spent something like 27 weeks in the Philippines, and I spent about 8 or 9 weeks in the Philippines on and off.
As the Philippines it's more than just Manila. There's thousands of islands.
Thousands of islands.
And where was the child?
In one of the worst areas, Mindanao province, where they were protected by a family. And the child was moved around from various provinces to friends, where they were protected by almost army-style security personnel.
Mindanao is an extremely dangerous place.
Extremely dangerous.
There's been a Muslim insurgency there for I don't know, decades now.
She was there for a short while and then moved again. And to succeed in that case, the general had one of his junior intelligence officers start dating the maid who was looking after the child. And through that, we succeeded in having the child brought out and the mother, and they were both taken on military aircraft, would you believe, to Hong Kong, and she was arrested by the Interpol representative there, and the child was taken back to Sweden, where the father was then residing.
Keith, is there a window of opportunity that closes with retrieving a child? I'm thinking if a child is abducted for whatever reason, to go to another country and then ends up spending 5 years there, loses the English language, has a whole series of friends, is reasonably well looked after by the parent. Does that then close? I mean, isn't that then a dangerous thing to do, to abduct a child out of the life they're now comfortable in?
It does. When the child is settled into another country or into another culture, usually about 18 months to 2 years, I wouldn't attempt to take a child after 2 years at the maximum.
So there is a window that
shuts?
Yes,
there is.
Has there been a case where a parent has commissioned you to retrieve a child and then changed?
Yes, there was. That was one in Fiji for an Australian mother who had married a Fijian. She was a missionary over there and married another missionary from the Methodist Church. And the marriage broke down. They were back here in Australia. And he took the children back to Fiji for a holiday. And most times that's the case. They take the children away for a holiday but fail to return. And she was unable to get the children back through through legal channels. So I went to Fiji with her and found where the children were living, and in fact went and visited the father with the children. And he believed that I was just from Australia, not to abduct the children, but that the mother had given me some money to give to him, and he was living in very poor circumstances, so he welcomed the $100 or whatever I gave to him.
What condition were the children in? Were they well looked after?
They were living in a village, in a house that had no windows or doors. It was just an open shell of a house, not too much furniture. But they were going to school, and that's where I first found the children at school. And I spoke to one of the children from school. The teacher allowed me to speak to the child, and I arranged to go to the house in the village that afternoon. And in fact, spoke to the father and the children, and the father filmed me with my own camcorder, hugging the children, talking to the children.
Why did you do that?
To get to know the child.
You asked him to do that, did you?
Yes, yes. I befriended the father because he thought I was sent over there to just, while I was there, to give them some money.
You were Father Christmas, were you?
Yeah, yeah, more or less. And to know the child, so as when he saw me the next day, we had planned to leave on the Qantas flight the next day, so when the child saw me on the way to school, he would come to me again and his mother would be there. But that night, the mother changed her mind. She met someone in Fiji who convinced her that if we abducted the children, it wouldn't be good for relationships between Australia and Fiji. So she disappeared. She went into hiding and just left a note saying she had changed her mind.
Well, she just lost her nerve then?
Just lost her nerve.
Well, you're right out on the limb at this point, aren't you?
Absolutely, Kate? And did not see her, didn't know where she was until we boarded our flight back to Australia later that day and she appeared on the aircraft. Wouldn't speak to us, and on arrival back in Australia, she was able to exit through the rear of the airport terminal, and she claimed that we were nothing but drug couriers and using her as an excuse to run drugs into Fiji.
Who did she claim that to?
To the airport security.
What happened to you then?
Her story wasn't believed, and we told them what the true story was, and we were allowed to go.
You had to say to airport security, no, her story that we're drug runners isn't a lie. In fact, we're there to abduct a child
This is what we were there for, to bring her children back.
You must have been in the airport for a long while explaining that one, Keith.
Yes, I was, but because of so many trips in and out of Australia, most of the immigration knew of me and knew what I was doing.
Keith, is there a danger with this sort of thing, with retrieving a child, that then there's a counter-retrieval and then there's this goes on tit for tat?
It can, but it's never happened in any of the cases I've been involved in. There's been threats of coming back and abducting the children again. And I've always then advised the mother or father to make sure there's an alert at the airport, at immigration, that the children are not to be removed, and usually a court order will then be in place. And I think that has to be renewed, or back then it had to be renewed every 3 or 6 months to keep the alert at the airport.
Do you need to prepare immigration in Australia for when you bring the child back? Do they have has DFAT sent them a notice of some kind so that they're prepared for you when you come back with the parent and children?
Yes, and the system works extremely well. When I brought the little girl back from Poland, there was an alert there for her to be apprehended if she ever came back in through the airport. And when I came back in with her, the official at immigration delayed us for a while, and the federal police came through and, of course, recognised who I was and what I was doing, and just more or less said, good job, Keith, you're able to go. Because the mother was there, they didn't need to hold the little girl. And left the mother go through.
Keith, I've read an account of those kids from Poland you retrieved, brought back to Australia, and now they're adults, and they expressed gratitude in this article I read that you had actually done that. Do you keep in touch with children? Have they kept in touch with you?
Yes, a number of the children I've kept in contact with and received Christmas cards and small letters from them. In fact, one of the children I brought back wrote a poem, and I think I may have a copy of it here, My Hero's Helping God, and she sent that to me for Christmas. And if I can read it, it says, My Hero's Helping God. Anything is possible, my hero has clearly shown, to those who have been stolen and feel like they're alone. They are taken in the night, oftentimes out of spite. Their hearts are filled with fright, and they know it can't be right. They go to school with different names, their kidnapper makes it like a game, but they think they are to blame, which fills them up with guilt and shame. He puts his life on the time, not just once, but time after time. Love for a child should not be a crime, but often it is when a marriage declines. He goes to places far away to chase the bad guys night and day. His family stay home and pray that everything will be okay. He says it's never easy and you can't win all the time. My hero's just helping God by retrieving one child at a time.
And that's been sent to you by a child you brought back?
By a child I brought back.
You also have a letter there addressed to one of your colleagues from Al Gore from when he was vice president. What was that about?
That was after the one of the retrievals. That was after a retrieval out of Khartoum in Sudan of an American child, and we were interviewed on the Maury Povich talkback show in the United States. I was hooked up from Australia, and one of our associates was in the Middle East. But we were on the Maury Povich show for 1 hour, and we lobbied to the people of the United States to write to the White House to have laws changed in relation to child kidnapping, child abduction.
Changed in what way?
To make it a felony offence, so there was much more severe penalties, and prior to that there wasn't. So a few days after we lobbied, there was more than 1 million letters arrived at the White House on one particular day. I've often tried to imagine how much space 1 million letters would take up at the White House. But anyway, as a result of that, we received a letter back from the Vice President, Al Gore.
And in essence, what did he have to say? Is he supportive?
He was supportive. He said, thank you for contacting my office. I appreciate hearing from you. President Clinton signed into law the International Parental Kidnapping Crime Act on December 2nd, 1993. This law underscores the seriousness with which the United States regards international child abduction by making this crime for the first time a federal felony offence. And it goes on to say a little bit more. But
so the law has been changed.
As a result of what we did and the lobbying we did, the law was changed in the United States.
So, Keith, you've seen, I suppose, what happens with a marriage when marriage is almost as bad as it gets here. I haven't asked you whether you're married yourself or... I don't know, what do you think about marriage when you see it at its... Where one parent is prepared to abduct a child out of spite?
It's sad when a marriage breaks down when there's children involved, and oftentimes it is in spite that the children are taken. And I think the laws of this country don't consider the child as much as they should, with access, visitation rights and so forth. And quite often, as you're aware, the mother will get almost full rights. The father won't have access or very limited access. And in spite, he'll go and break the court order and take the children away. And I think there could be a better relationship after marriage breakdown between the parents and the children. It's the children that have to suffer in all cases.
Keith, it's been great to meet you, and thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard. That was a pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.